Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this evening, along with his dad, filmed the 1962 NFL championship game with a 16mm Bell & Howell wind-up movie camera. From that humble beginning, NFL Films has revolutionized the way America watches football. 49 years later, he's the president of NFL Films, the winner of 34 Emmys, and one of nine people who have attended all 45 Super Bowls. His name, Steve Sable. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with the president and one of the founding members with his dad of NFL Films, Steve Sable. Steve, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack.
Can you start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I can't imagine anyone having a better childhood than I did. It was like a combination of Lucy and Desi and Ozzie and Harriet. My mom and dad had a great relationship. In fact, this summer they're going to be celebrating their 70th wedding anniversary. And my sister and I grew up in a household that was filled with creativity, with love, and more than anything, a sense of humor.
What's the biggest thing, Steve, you learned from your mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from your dad?
Well, I think what I learned from both of them is that you can approach everything in life as a potential source of humor. And something that really seems bad, in retrospect, when you look at it 3 months later, a year later, there's always something funny about that experience. And my mom would always say if I was sick or I would, you know, with the childhood maladies or something was wrong at school, or she'd always say, if this is the worst thing that's going to happen to you in your whole life, you're going to be very lucky. And that always put things in perspective. My father, first of all, I'd have to clarify that my father was not only my father, he was my role model. He became my boss. He's the funniest person I've ever met. And when I look at my dad's whole life, the message of his whole life is that there are dreams to be pursued and there are trails to be blazed no matter what age you are. And my dad was always someone that was a source of energy and humor throughout my whole life, even when he became my boss. And to last week when he was chosen to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame and I visited him in Arizona, even at 95. And with his health failing, he still has that great sense of humor. And to me, that's what I got from both my parents.
Speaking of pursuing dreams, let's go back to 1962. Your dad is 48. He's working for your grandfather selling overcoats.
He hated it. He would come home, and my grandfather ran the Jacob Sigal Overcoat Company, and he was a Romanian immigrant. He didn't speak that, really was fluent in English, and every weekend he would come to our house for dinner, and he was just a real tough, hard businessman. He started out making the overcoats himself and built the business himself, and he looked at my dad as sort of a ne'er-do-well in a way. That my dad was always sneaking off from work to watch me play football when I was in grade school and high school, and my grandfather would sit there and say, "What is it with a football? Who cares? You got a business to run here. You shouldn't be worrying about this football." But my dad and I often think that it's too bad my grandfather couldn't have lived to see what my dad did with that football. I think even he would have been proud.
Well, your dad makes a phone call to Commissioner Pete Rozelle, and that phone call changes America. Tell us about that phone call.
Well, it really wasn't even a phone call, Jack. It was in 1961. My dad had I had left for college, and he had filmed me playing football all the way up from fourth grade to my senior year in Haverford School in Pennsylvania. I went away to college, and he decided he'd had enough selling overcoats. He wanted to make his hobby, which was filming me playing football and home movies, he wanted to make that hobby into a profession. And he found out that the rights, the film rights for the 1962 championship game, would NFL championship game, were annually sold to the highest bidder. So he went to the auction in Pete Rozelle's office, and they opened the bids, and my dad's bid was double what anyone else's bid. That was always his theory. If you want something, go out, balls and all, and go after it. And it was $5,000. Pete Rozelle looked at my dad's bid and was, oh, that's terrific. The $5,000 to do the NFL championship game, that's great. Then he looked at Dad's application, which said experience filming football, and then my dad honestly wrote, filming my 14-year-old son. Well, needless to say, that Pete was a little concerned about that. But as my dad tells the story, being a salesman, after a three-martini lunch at 21 in New York, that was a famous restaurant, Pete finally agreed to give my father the chance to do the championship game. That night, Dad had called me and he said, listen, I just got the rights to do the NFL championship game, and I can see by your grades all that you've been doing out there in Colorado is playing football and going to the movies. That makes you uniquely qualified for this job. So over Christmas vacation, I left school a week early and helped my dad do the first championship game in 1962. It was the Packers defeated the Giants 16-7, and that was the first football game, first NFL game that we filmed. And at that time, we were not NFL Films. My dad started a company called Blair Motion Pictures, which was named after my sister, and it was him and a secretary and two cameramen, and then I came in for the championship game. But that was our first game.
And the camera that you used was?
Well, we were a bunch of cameras. We used the Bell & Howell that my dad used. We used Arriflexes as well. They were World War II combat cameras, and those were the cameras that our six cameramen use, in addition to the little Bell & Howell camera that my dad used to film me.
We're talking to Steve Sable, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Steve Sable, who has personally received 34 Emmy Awards for writing, cinematography, editing, directing, and producing. Steve, what did you do with that film of the 62 championship game, you and your dad?
Well, we took that film and we made it into a half-hour film. And you have to go back to the early 60s, and that our first couple shows weren't even on television. We did the 62 championship, the 63 championship, the 64 championship, and then my dad got the idea maybe the NFL would buy our family business, because every year the rights fee went up for that championship game. And my father felt, well, sooner or later, a CBS or an MGM or 20th Century Fox is going to realize there's a future here with this pro football, and they would outbid him. So in 1965, what he did was he made a proposal to the owners, and they agreed, and the 12 owners each put up $20,000, and Blair Motion Pictures became NFL Films. But in the very beginning, the only people that would see our films were people that Mason Lodges, Veterans of Foreign Wars banquets, Cub Scout meetings, Rotarian conventions, and we would get that film and we would put it in our station wagon with a projector and a one of those accordion screens, and we would go to these different meetings and banquets all up and down the East Coast. And once in a while, Frank Gifford would go with us, or Alex Webster, or Del Schaffner. Those were two players for the Giants, and they would introduce the film, and we would show it. A couple times I forgot the screen, and we end up putting a bed sheet up at a Cub Scout meeting to show the film in. But it wasn't until 1965 and 66, when we became NFL Films, that our films began to appear regularly on television.
65 was a good year, a great year for you. It was also an iconic breakthrough for you with the documentary, They Call It Pro Football. Talk about that.
Oh, that, as Sports Illustrated said 10 years later, that was the Citizen Kane of sports movies. That was the film that really the style of NFL films all came together in that one film. It was the first film that we used the voice of John Facenda and the music of Sam Spence. It was the first sports film to use montage style editing. It was the first football film that we shot a ground level slow motion. The first time a coach was mic'd for sound. It was the first time we had a camera just focused on the quarterback for after he threw the ball. It was the first time follies and bloopers ever appeared in a film. And when Pete Rozelle saw that film, we had the premiere of it in the Walter Reed Theater, and he came up and he says, you know, that isn't a highlight film. That was a real film. And in fact, the next day, he called up my father, and he said, I want you, you and Steve, to come up to my office. I wanted to talk to you. So we drove up. We were NFL Films is still located in the suburbs of Philadelphia. We're in New Jersey right now. But when we got to his office, he opened up his desk and he showed us a piece of paper, and it was the Nielsen ratings. I didn't really know what that was, but he said, look at this. These are the television ratings. Number one is baseball. Number two is college football. And here's the National Football League. We're three. If this league ever expects to flourish and prosper, we have to succeed on television. And in order to succeed on television, you need an image and a mystique. And the film that you made that I saw yesterday is the kind of image and mystique that's going to help this game grow. And that was the closest to a mission statement that we ever got. But that particular film launched us. That was the beginning, the genesis of the style that people now associate with NFL films.
A lot of people wanted you to use the voice of Jack Whitaker or Kurt Gowdy or Chris Schenkel. Where did you find this voice of God, John Facenda?
Well, one of the things that Dad and I both felt very strongly about is that we wanted to present pro football the way Hollywood portrayed fiction, with a dramatic flair. And one of the elements of that type of filmmaking would be the narrator. Prior to us, Dan Endy, a very talented Philadelphian, used to write the scripts for the highlight films that were produced by Telraw. And a couple of his lines would go like, Milt Plum pegs a peach of a pass to become the apple of Coach George Wilson's eye. Very clever, very breezy, and very repeatable. But I wanted to show football in a more documentary style, and I wanted to have less words as opposed to more words. So what I thought is the less words that you have, the more important is the voice that's going to be narrating that. And we had a list of three people that we wanted to use. First was Orson Welles. He turned us down. The second voice we wanted to use was Richard Basehart. He was the voice, the narrator, for Victory at Sea. He had no interest in football. The third voice was a local Philadelphia anchorman. He was the Walter Cronkite of Philadelphia. His name was John Facenda. And we thought he would have a good voice. He was our third choice. My dad met him. John said he didn't know that much about football, but my father said, well, my son's going to write the script for you. All you have to do is read it. So John agreed to do it, and we went into a recording studio about 2 weeks later, and I'll never forget the first lines that I wrote for John Facenda, and it was in They Call It Pro Football, and he read it, it starts with a whistle and ends with a gun, and just the way he said it. And I looked at my dad, who was outside the glass booth, and our eyes met, and we knew we were onto something. It must have been how Sam Phillips felt in Sun Studio when Elvis first, strummed his guitar and sang the first lyrics of his first song. But oddly enough, a lot of the owners didn't like Fassenda in the beginning. They wanted a Kurt Gowdy or a Chris Schenkel. So we had to convince them that we're making films in a different style. And they were saying, well, he doesn't know anything about football. And it was a while before we convinced them he doesn't have to know anything about football because Steve is writing the scripts for him. He's just reading the scripts. So after two or three years, the public's reaction to Fassenda was overwhelming, and everybody thought he was great. And then a few of the owners said, okay, Ed, you're probably right. You can stay with John Fassenda. And John narrated most of our films up until his death in 1983.
Talk about, Steve Sable, if you will, the technological changes in cameras just in the last 10 years.
Well, Jack, to be very honest with you, I started out as a cameraman, I started out as an editor, and then I saw things that I said, God, if the cameraman shifted over here, or he zoomed in here, then I became a cameraman. But I was never a technically guy. I had a great assistant, Hank McGelwee, who is now our director of photography, and he would load the camera for me with a magazine, and all I ever did was focus it and zoom. I was sort of like a race car driver. Just put me in the car. Don't tell me about the tires and the gas and everything. Let me go. So the camera that I used then was a French camera called an Eclair, which I liked because I could move it around. Like, I didn't have to look through the lens piece a lot of times. I could hold it by my ankles. I could hold it over my head. A lot of people frowned on that style, but I thought it was... It, in a way, reflected the game of football itself, that it was a very frenetic kind of style, and it gave you angles that you wouldn't see if you were up on a tripod. But now we're using all different types of cameras, from high-definition cameras to small, like still cameras that we use. But I've never been a person who was interested in the names or the technology. I only cared about what went up on the screen.
Many people have said that if God has a voice, his voice will sound like John Fassenda. And here's a little clip of John Fassenda.
There's glory in the legends of this hard muscle life, and there's poetry in each season made of sweat and strife. Winds whisper of high hopes. Victory is in the skies. A season awaits with glory in her eyes. One joins with many on summer's green field. Time to strive, to dare, for all not to yield.
That's John Fassenda. We're with Steve Sable, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now, back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Brasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Steve Sable and his 95-year-old dad, who he's worked with for 49 years, just got inducted into the Football Hall of Fame a week ago. What's your dad's thoughts, Steve, about getting into the Football Hall of Fame?
Well, Jack, I think... When he got inducted, my dad was, he's living in Arizona, and I was at the Super Bowl, and I called him right after his name was announced, and we were reminiscing about his whole life. And when you think of my dad's life, at 19 years old, he set the world record for the 100-meter freestyle. Then he went to the Army. He landed on Utah Beach on D-Day plus 12, and he served under General Patton. He came back, sold overcoats, and then realized his dream in founding NFL Films. But it was really, it's a culmination of a long love affair with making movies and the sport of football. And my father combined those two loves and created a film company that celebrated and documented the NFL. And last week, the NFL celebrated him by inducting him into the Hall of Fame.
One of your quotes from your dad is, "Tell me a fact and I'll learn. Tell me a truth and I'll believe. But tell me a story and it will live in my heart forever." We love storytellers. Here at WJR, we've got a world-class one in Mitch Albom. What is it about storytellers that people love?
Well, I think to bring it back to NFL films, one of the things that my father and I both believed, that we both looked at football in dramaturgical terms, that it wasn't the outcome, it wasn't the final score, it was the struggle. How we reached the final score. Those were the things that my father was interested in, the face behind the mask. And when you look at a camera, it can be an instrument of realism, and it can be a creator of myth. And I think at NFL Films, we use it in both ways. As an instrument of realism, you can see Hard Knocks, our series that's on HBO. And then as a creator of myth, you can see our America's Game that's on the NFL Network, or the documentary we recently did on HBO on Lombardi. But to us, to get back to the point, the story, it was the struggle that was just as important as the outcome.
Your dad's life is one risk, one dream after another after another. Talk to us, if you will, Steve Sable, about taking risks in life.
Well, it's so important, Jack, in our business to take risks. That was something that my father really stressed to him. I would say his greatest talent was his optimism and his enthusiasm, and then recognizing talent in others. But to work with someone like this in our business, in the movie business, that it's so important to take risks, to innovate. And my father always felt that the biggest risk was not taking a risk. And he had a saying, and he would always encourage us to try new things. And he would always say, don't worry about making a mistake. Don't worry. That's part of the process. And he had an expression. He would say, if you want to soar with the eagles, you can't crap like a canary, meaning if you have big dreams, don't worry about small mistakes. And with my father, he put quality before any other consideration. And we barely made a profit in our first 20 years, despite our popularity. But the idea, and it was very important, it was quality, and Pete Rozelle stressed that. He says, you're representing the NFL, and the most important part of thing of the NFL is quality. And that was drummed into all of us from the very beginning.
Steve Sable, NFL films have won over 100 Emmys. First question is, where do you keep 100-plus Emmys?
Well, we have a big shelf here, and then some of the Emmys have been made into lamps. Some producers use them as books, you know, bookcases, but we have a row here. If you walk into NFL Films in our lobby, we have a whole wall that has 100 Emmys on it.
All right. Becoming the best is a lifelong journey. But as tough as it is to become the best, it's even tougher to stay the best. How have you stayed the best year after year after year?
Well, I think you it's the people, that you have to have people who it's like there's a difference between a goal and a purpose. If you have a certain goal, you often reach that goal, and then, well, where do you go for next? Where do you go next? But I've always felt that more important than a goal is a purpose. A purpose reestablish itself every year, and the purpose is to make great films. And that is the thing that it drives us and has driven us for 49 years. When we started, it was a bunch of young guys who loved to make movies and who loved pro football and wanted to convey that love of the game to our audience. And that's the same philosophy we have today, although we have different editing techniques, better equipment, technological advances. The core of what we do has remained the same.
Let's go back to 65, and Rozelle calls you and your dad in and shows you this Nielsen rating, you know, baseball, college football, then the NFL. Well, now the NFL is the kingfish. How do you explain America's love affair with the NFL?
Well, I think when you look at when you look at the game, it has it's sort of the four horsemen of our culture: violence, artistry, celebrity, and noise. Those are the things that are interwoven in our culture, and each one of those elements is taken almost to the extreme in the National Football League. But I think there's so many reasons why it's so popular. Number one, it stresses teamwork. Number two, it's a sport that lends itself brilliantly to television. A football field is the same size as a movie screen, a television screen. I think that the league has had great leadership with Pete Rozelle and with Paul Tagliabue, the commissioner, and now with Roger Goodell. And I just think it's the elements of the game, the fierce physical nature of the sport, the competition, the history, and the traditions. You bring those all together. And then you've got a sport that, oddly enough, doesn't translate overseas. I mean, the NFL has tried to sell itself in Europe, and it really hasn't worked. It's sort of like soccer coming over here. The NFL is so ingrained in our culture, and it mirrors our culture, and you have to understand our culture. I don't think that it's ever going to be big in Europe, and as I said, soccer will never be a big sport here in the United States.
What does football, Steve Sable, teach us about life?
I think you go back to sacrifice, hard work. It teaches you to be part of something larger than yourself and be proud of it. It teaches you about overcoming the odds. It teaches you to appreciate your teamwork, your teammate, and it teaches you to something that Lombardi always talked about, to love your teammate, to care about your teammate. I think that's probably the most important thing that football teaches is the respect for your teammate and respect for your opponent.
Here's another segment, another cut from John Facenda.
Football is a rough game and often a cruel one.
Every time you lose, you die a little bit. You die inside, a portion of you. Not all of your organs, maybe just your liver.
Pain is inevitable.
They're killing me, Whitey, they're killing me!
There was only the painful face of failure.
Okay, fellas, hey fellas, this is what you work all off season for. This is why you lift all them weights. This is why you do all that.
There was a fighting heart under the ribs of defeat.
Never give up, baby, never give up.
That's John Facenda. We're with Steve Sable, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking with Steve Sable, and he's one of only 9 people who have attended all 45 Super Bowls. Steve, I heard Steve Young the other day talking about once in a great while, a player comes along that tilts the field. Of all the defensive players you've ever filmed, who tilted the field the most?
Oh, Dick Butkus. He was, to me, if someone asked me to name the greatest football players, Jim Brown, Dick Butkus probably would. Jerry Rice would be right up, and Otto Graham. Those 3 or 4 to me would be the greatest of all time. But Dick Butkus was a force of unmanageable proportions. And his career as a middle linebacker for the Chicago Bears stands as the most sustained work of devastation ever committed on a football field by anyone, anywhere, anytime. In 1969, the Bears won 1 game, and yet Butkus was voted the defensive player of the year. And to me, he stood for something just as important as victory. He gave everything he had on every play. No player ever played harder or better than Dick Butkus.
Who was the most electrifying player you ever filmed?
I would say that would be very close, Jack, between Barry Sanders and Gale Sayers. Barry Sanders is a close second to me to Sayers. Barry made moves that were indescribable. Gale Sayers had moves that were unimaginable.
Sayers, I think, only played 44 games.
I think it was actually 68, Jack, and he became the youngest player ever inducted in the Hall of Fame, and I was there when George Halas introduced him. George Halas was his presenter, and the last words that Halas spoke before he handed the bust over to Gale Sayers was, "We'll never see his likes again," and that was true.
The most colorful player or coaches you've ever filmed?
The most colorful player? Boy, that could be, it could be Lyle Alzado. It could be Art Donovan. Colorful, I'm not sure what, you know, Jack, what you mean by colorful. I mean, maybe memorable. In that category, I would say Jim Brown was the greatest ball carrier. But no one ever played the position of running back as well and as completely as Walter Payton. He was a crushing blocker. I saw him lift blitzers off their feet when it was required. He was an effective decoy who followed through convincingly on all his fakes. I saw him punt in practice. He once led the Bears in kickoff returns. He's Chicago's all-time leading receiver. To me, in addition to all of that, he only missed one game in his entire career. So maybe the word colorful, maybe my definition of it would be the career of Walter Payton.
You know, and his moniker was Sweetness, and anybody that ever met him, I mean, that was Sweetness, you know?
Well, the other thing people forget about Walter, how strong he was. He had hands like bear traps. And there was a period where every year he was winning awards, a man of the year, a player of the year, offensive. And I was often at the banquets, and it was my job to introduce him. And I would sit next to him. And he had a prank that he would pull on me all the time. The minute I would stand up to introduce him, he would grab my butt with his hands. And his hands were so strong, he would pinch my butt so hard that the next day I'd have a black and blue mark right on the cheek of my butt from Walter Payton.
Now, in August of this year, your dad's going with six other Hall of Famers, two of which are Dion and Shannon Sharpe. What's your predictions about their speeches?
Well, I would assume that everyone else will have to be pretty short, because with Dion and Shannon, they're going to be... But they'll be long, but they'll be fun, and I'm sure they'll be the highlights of the evening, because both Dion and Shannon have a lot to say, and they express themselves very well.
ESPN has revolutionized America, at least men in America. Talk about what ESPN has meant for NFL films, and vice versa.
Well, ESPN really gave us a platform that was unprecedented. Before ESPN, most of our shows were syndicated, meaning they were shown at a different time, and sometimes our shows were Saturday night or Sunday mornings. ESPN gave the sports fan appointment viewing, a place to go. The minute you turn on your TV, you would go to ESPN for SportsCenter, the latest news. But ESPN were responsible for my abbreviated and short career as a host. When we started our show, the NFL Films Presents, Pat Summerall and Frank Gifford were the hosts, and when ESPN started, they wanted to use that show. But Frank and Pat, because of a contract with CBS, that weren't interested in being on this ESPN or whatever it was called, Entertainment and Sports, whatever network. So a week before we were supposed to go on the air, Tom O'Jackson, who was the programming director at ESPN in 1978, said, "Well, who's going to be the host?" And I said, "Scott, I don't know, because Pat and Frank can't do it." And Tom said, "Well, look, you've been writing it for them all the time. Why don't you do it?" I said, "Well, I've the only time I ever stood up in front of an audience was an 11th grade speaking contest at Haverford School. I'll never forget what he said. He said, "Why don't you go ahead and do it? And don't worry, because nobody's going to be watching anyway." And that's when my on-camera career began with ESPN, with those encouraging words.
One of your current projects is a documentary on Lombardi that's due out in 2012. What's the love affair with this man, Vince Lombardi?
Well, I think, first of all, with Lombardi, that he was not obsessed with winning so much as excellence and effort. There were times in the locker room where a team would win, his team would win, but play poorly, and he'd chew them out. There were other times, a few times, when the team lost, but if he felt they gave all their effort, he never was that rough on them. He's the patron saint of pro football. He's a rare man, as good as his legend. His presence was so strong that it still lives. Whenever and wherever we compete, Lombardi's spirit still summons up the best we have to offer.
A lot of people know you, but not many people know that your first love came from your mom, and that's art. Talk about your first love and art.
Well, my mother ran an art gallery in Philadelphia in the 1950s, and she was the first person in the city that recognized the potential and the future of pop art. So she had a lot of these young artists come to her gallery and exhibit their work. Robert Rauschenberg, Roy Lichtenstein, Wayne Thiebaud, Jasper Johns, Klaus Oldenburg. It's a hall of fame of pop artists. And they first exhibited in my mom's gallery in Philadelphia. And they would, when they exhibited, they would often stay at our house. So I was privileged to have dinner with all these great artists. Of course, then they were hardly known, but I was fascinated by their interpretation of what was art. And I decided then that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an artist, and that was my major in college. I majored in mixed media, but then I got sidetracked when my dad started NFL Films, and that was the end of my art career. But I still am involved in art. I've had a couple. I had a show at the Super Bowl. I've had several shows in New York and Washington, and I have a website, stevesableart.com, and I've had a little extra time now, and I've reinvigorated my art career, and I've been doing pieces now for maybe 15 years, and as I said, I've had several shows.
As our time winds down together, Steve Sable, what advice would you leave our young listeners with tonight?
I would say find something that you love to do, and don't worry about making money, because if you find something that you really love to do, you'll work at it. And if you work at it, you'll be good at it. And if you're good at it, you'll make some money. But the key is to find something that you really love. That would be my advice to all of the young people that are listening today.
Steve Sable, talk about a man using the talents that was given to him by God and making the world a better place to live. You've done that with your dad, your people at MFL Films. Please keep up the great work.
Thank you very much, Jack.
Honored to have you. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohm.